Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In this lecture, held on January 14, 2018, Judith Brody presents the special installation of 18 drawings, 2 photographs, and an assortment of small sculptures by Saul Steinberg. Revered by millions for his outstanding covers for the New Yorker magazine, Steinberg was an extraordinary draftsman whose line, according to the art critic Harold Rosenberg, was delectable in itself. Whether making independent works or ones for publication, Steinberg brought a mordant wit and a sharp eye to all his art, creating works that disarm, enchant, and electrify. On view from September 12, 2017 through May 18, 2018, the special installation spans the years 1945 to 1984 and includes a wide range of subjects and types, from World War II air raids to New York hipsters, from collages incorporating real stationery to bogus documents enhanced with fake signatures and seals.
Steinberg was born in a small town in Romania in June 1914, very shortly before the outbreak of World War I. His parents were of Russian Jewish descent. The family moved to Bucharest the following year, where Steinberg's father, Moritz, opened a printing and bookbinding shop. With Romania's entry into the war in 1916, Moritz was conscripted for military service, and the rest of the family relocated to be near relatives. They returned to Bucharest at the close of the war, at which time Steinberg's father went into the box manufacturing business, producing decorative packaging for candy, cosmetics, and other merchandise. It was at his father's factory that Steinberg first gained familiarity with materials such as colored and embossed papers, rubber stamps, in wooden movable type, all of which later would figure in his art. Despite the fact that half the students at the school were Jewish, Steinberg got his first real taste of anti-Semitism in elementary school. The same prejudice existed in high school and at the University of Bucharest, where he enrolled in 1932, anti-Semitism was rampant. When relatives from the U.S. who had immigrated there from Romania visited Steinberg's family in Bucharest, Steinberg recalled being electrified by their beauty and also the smell of America. He was, he said, embarrassed to be part of what he called a primitive civilization, and he pledged to himself to leave. And that he did. In 1933, Steinberg moved to Milan to study architecture at the Regio Politecnico and soon became deeply engaged in drawing, contributing cartoons regularly to Italian newspapers specializing in humor and satire. Racial laws imposed in 1938 by Mussolini, however, which included barring Jews from skilled professions, put a halt to that. Steinberg remained in Italy long enough to earn his architectural degree, but all the while he looked for refuge in another country. His diploma in architecture, issued in the name of Vittorio Emanuele III, King of Italy, states very clearly that Steinberg is of the Razza Ebraica, the Hebrew race, leaving little doubt as to his fate in the country. After departing Europe, Steinberg spent a year in the Dominican Republic before being granted a U.S. visa. In the summer of 1942, he arrived in Manhattan, remarkably having already published drawings in The New Yorker, Mademoiselle, and other periodicals, assignments that were arranged through an agent. On February 19, 1943, the same day that Steinberg was commissioned as an ensign in the U.S. Naval Reserve, he became an American citizen. Assigned to Naval Intelligence, he shipped out to China in May 1943, transferred 6 months later to the new Office of Strategic Services, or OSS. He was sent to North Africa and then Italy, where he is pictured here. His duties involved the preparation of pictorial propaganda, some of which was dropped over Germany to advance the fiction of a German resistance movement. The the propaganda was, of course, meant to look authentic, as if produced by an inexperienced artist. In fact, an OSS document specified that the propaganda should look as if it was made in haste and in a style like that of a cartoonist. Returning stateside in October 1944, Steinberg married Hedda Stern, also an artist and also an emigre from Romania. The couple would separate 16 years later, but they never divorced, maintaining close ties until Steinberg's death. Through Stern, Steinberg met other émigré artists, such as André Breton, Marcel Duchamp, and Mondrian. Over time, he also formed lasting friendships with Alexander Calder, Richard Lindner, Ad Reinhardt, Mark Rothko, and the art critic Harold Rosenberg. His work was exhibited alongside the likes of Gorky, Motherwell, Noguchi, and Mark Toby in the Museum of Modern Art's 1946 exhibition, 14 Americans. In 1952, the Betty Parsons and Sidney Janis Galleries mounted an exhibition of his work, giving rise to a series of exhibits in the US and elsewhere. All in all, Steinberg gained quick acceptance in his adopted country. But despite that, he continued to maintain the vantage point of an outsider, a visiting inspector of sorts, studying the main streets and manners of his adopted country. I have to admit that I always look at this drawing and wonder why a donut is floating down Main Street of a Western ghost town. Let's turn now to the installation of works by Steinberg in the East Building, the occasion of which prompted this talk today. In 2016, the National Gallery received a very generous gift of 34 drawings and a sketchbook from the Saul Steinberg Foundation. The installation, representing a little more than half that gift, spans the years 1945 to 1984 and includes a wide range of subjects and types, from World War II air raids to New York hipsters, from collages incorporating airmail envelopes and stationery, to bogus documents enhanced with fake signatures and seals. I want to point out that these are, in fact, fake signatures. There is no true John Hancock in the group. Also, the text above the cluster of signatures is meaningless gibberish. I emphasize this because I have stood in front of this drawing with people who insist that they could decipher it if only they had their reading glasses. I am here to tell you that it is not possible. The text is unintelligible and was meant to be so. I encountered a similar problem in relation to the three envelopes on view in this vitrine, the two laid flat and the one propped up vertically. Here they are during unpacking. People kept assuming that the envelopes are real. Instead of continually pointing out their mistake, I had the label on the vitrine changed, so it now reads, "The envelopes and notepad displayed here are made of wood, not paper." Among other talents, Steinberg was a first-class trickster. He fabricated items such as these to incorporate in larger sculptures and reliefs, and sometimes to present as gifts to friends. Indeed, one friend, Ian Frazier, a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine, told me that Steinberg would actually put wooden envelopes like these directly in the mail, adding proper US stamps, but no sort of protective packaging. And amazingly, they would get postmarked and delivered and usually intact. In his book about Steinberg, Joel Smith writes that mail for Steinberg presented one of the minor perfections of 20th century life. For a few pennies and a walk to the mailbox, thoughts on paper could be sent around the globe. Through the civic church of the post office, the state's massive machinery knelt to serve the needs of private life. Meanwhile, supplying Steinberg with the stamps, seals, and insignia by which he represented the public realm of officialdom. The mail carriers must have taken as much care with Steinberg's envelopes as the dozen or so earnest-looking figures shown marching here to the left, each with an item in hand. The two men at upper right balance a filigreed signature over their heads. The rest carry words and items, not drawn, but actually rubber-stamped onto the paper. The words read, fragile, rush, approved, void. A figure at lower center, right here, holds the word, holds the word important under his arm. In front of him, a man carries a bust of Abraham Lincoln, and most hilarious to my mind is the rather sullen-looking man in the lower left corner who holds an actual thumbprint in his hand. Our thumbs, of course, being the most fundamental rubber stamps of all. Steinberg once made a note about wanting to have a rubber stamp made of his own fingerprint, an indexical brain teaser, if ever there was one, and a perfect instance of Steinbergian thinking. In fact, he had many rubber stamps fabricated to his specifications, these being just a sampling of ones in his inventory. He used these bespoke rubber stamps in making drawings, a term I use loosely. In this one, he used them nearly exclusively. Aside from a faint pencil line here and there, the entire composition is rendered, as it were, using rubber stamps. There is a brilliance to the drawing that has nothing to do with luster and everything to do with wit and intelligence. The notion of using a manufactured stamp to represent a manufacturing site, the concept of a skilled draftsman whose line could flow elegantly, Harold Rosenberg called it delectable in itself, dispensing with that virtuoso line and turning instead to rubber stamps, and the absolutely zany idea of having rubber stamps fabricated so as to replicate lines, hatch marks, and stippling, some of the basic vocabulary of drawing and engraving, all underscore the brilliance of this work. And here is another composition rendered mainly using rubber stamps and additionally these French curves in blue. You'll note here that this is a whole army force of artists at their easels. Steinberg's vantage point as an outsider, as I said earlier, a visiting inspector of sorts, gave him exceptional insight when it came to the observation of others. Each guest at this chic cocktail party is represented in a different style. Steinberg used a pointillist technique to depict the woman at right wearing black-rimmed eyeglasses. He employed a stippling method for the seated woman at lower left, a figure so insubstantial as to be an existential crisis. The man in the checkered suit seated on the couch back here is the aforementioned Harold Rosenberg. Steinberg had an active social life and would have been a regular at cocktail parties such as this one. You can imagine him standing at a distance, sizing the group up. While Steinberg was friendly with abstract expressionists such as Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning, he was not one to hang out with them at the Cedar Tavern. He didn't fit comfortably in that crowd, nor was his art anything like theirs. His friend, the artist Mary Frank, remarked that, quote, he was somehow not treated as the great artist he was. People would say, yes, he's fantastic, but then they'd call him a cartoonist, and the word cartoonist had a bad edge to it. A decade later, Steinberg directed his attention to another group of conversation makers, this one made up not of people, but of graphic symbols. The rectangular form seated on a chair in the forefront is presumably in discussion with the fuzzy spiral seated in the comfy armchair. Three lively figures occupy the couch in the back, and notably, the one at center is in the midst of a very demonstrative outburst. While few of the drawings donated to the National Gallery by the Saul Steinberg Foundation were published in The New Yorker, this one is an exception. It was published in The New Yorker in 1962, and again in Life magazine in somewhat modified form in 1966. As demonstrated, Steinberg enjoyed playing with styles of art, cubism or pointillism, and techniques such as hatching and stippling. In this marvelous invented family portrait, each of the figures is represented in a different manner. The older woman in the wicker chair, drawn in brown pencil, looks as if she just stepped out of a vintage sepia photograph. The child on her lap is drawn in waxy crayon in the sort of childish style that a child would actually use. Sticks for arms, a circle for a head, and a broad red curve for a smile. Interestingly, at least once Steinberg described himself as a child who never stopped drawing. We grin in response to his family portrait, not because of an amusing narrative or caption, but because it is an acutely self-reflexive work, referring to its own making. It turns back on itself, a little like Steinberg's remark about wanting a rubber stamp of his own thumbprint. Like the drawing on the right, Steinbergs often refer to their own making. They also often have an autobiographical thread to them, as does this drawing of a man drawing at the table. And I know from listening to Steinberg on videos that he often started his work in the studio every day by doing something very similar to this, drawing a man drawing, just to get the juices flowing. This one, obviously, is more obviously a self-portrait, and it was done at the age of 70. And I should point out that there are aspects of the drawing that ring true and others that do not. For example, the studio in which Steinberg pictures himself bears no resemblance to any that he ever occupied. For someone who claimed that he was suspicious of art with a capital A, he certainly inserted a lot of capital A art in this drawing. On the wall behind him is an array of works that inspired him. For example, a painting by Mondrian, composition with blue and yellow, which coincidentally is a work in the collection of the Hirshhorn Museum. And I reproduce it here to the right. You are looking now at a poor image, and I apologize for that, of two paintings by Steinberg, ones he called false Mondrians. A critic once wrote of seeing them on a visit to Steinberg's apartment, and Steinberg explaining that he had painted them himself. Quote, but they are not copies, he insisted. They are invented Mondrians, he said. You see, for me, Mondrian is the key to modern art. Among artists, he is the true intellect, the purest. The others made games. They were collages, most of them. But the true important elements in art for me are the first waves of cubism and Mondrian. Anyway, what I understood was how difficult it was to do a Mondrian. If you look at Mondrian, you say, how simple. You do a few lines and use three colors and that's it. But it's not. You have to impersonate Mondrian in order to understand him. Steinberg said, it's like hunger and cold. In order to understand hunger and cold, you have to be hungry and cold, and only then do you know what it is. So when I made those Mondrians, I wanted to find out how he did it. You can't figure that out unless you do it. Works by Mondrian appear repeatedly in Steinberg's work. Here, for example, on the wall to the left, and there are many others. Getting back to the self-portrait, highlighted is the painting L'Arlésien by Vincent van Gogh. And here it appears in reality. And to the right of Steinberg's head, the 19th century French artist Jean-François Millet's Angelus, a painting at the Musée d'Orsay of two peasants in a field, their heads bowed in prayer. Millet had special meaning to Steinberg, evoking childhood memories of his father's box-making business. Steinberg wrote, and here I quote, that the factory also produced boxes for chocolates, bonbons, and sugar-coated almonds, deluxe boxes on whose glossy covers was an artistic reproduction in chromolithography. Millet was ideal for chocolate boxes, according to Steinberg, because he combined the classicism of the Renaissance with socialism, which at that time, Steinberg was speaking of the teens in the 1920s, was popular. Many of these images I was seeing for the first time, he wrote, without knowing they were art. Millet's painting pops up regularly in Steinberg's work, not only on the wall behind these glamorous tango dancers, but also stamped onto drawings, for he had the famous painting by Millet fabricated as a rubber stamp, which here he stamped onto multiple postcards to create a collage. And you can see these characters on every, on the beach, in the landscape, at a place, in the field, as they would have appeared in the original painting. And then he would also sometimes stamp them onto drawings, such as this watercolor. Another work that inspired him was this Goya, which is at the Prado, the nude Maja, to the right of Steinberg's head. And here it is in reality. And here, another painting by Millet, The Sower. Which brings me to a work by Norman Rockwell, his triple self-portrait. What I'm going to suggest is that Steinberg's self-portrait takes its inspiration from this painting by Rockwell, another artist who did covers for magazines, most famously the Saturday Evening Post, and who, like Steinberg, was a very successful commercial artist. Not that artists, by the way, who make so-called fine art don't traffic in commerce. Tacked to the upper right of Rockwell's painting are works placed there as inspiration. Right up here. A self-portrait from 1498 by Albrecht Dürer, a self-portrait by Rembrandt, an unidentified painting by Picasso, and lastly, at the bottom, a self-portrait of Van Gogh at his easel. Though Steinberg was represented at museums during his lifetime, and the Whitney Museum of American Art mounted a major retrospective of his work in 1978, he generally had an uneasy relationship with the museum world, a situation shared by Rockwell. So in Steinberg's self-portrait drawing, is he perhaps channeling Rockwell, another artist with something of an outsider status in the art world? Curiously, in Steinberg's self-portrait, he does not depict himself with the mustache that he, in fact, had the year this drawing was made. He also seems never to have smoked a pipe, whereas the clean-shaven Rockwell is almost invariably pictured holding one. There is an image at upper right in the self-portrait that is rather unusual. It resembles a series of pictures made by a Japanese artist called, and I may be mispronouncing this, Hibata Osuka, who, in the mid-19th century, made portraits of American Navy officers in Commodore Perry's 1852 Japan expedition. This one may be a likeness of Perry himself, aiming his gaze at Steinberg and looking strangely foreign against a Japanese-style backdrop. He looks decidedly like an outsider. Having had the chance to read Lynn Cook's essay in the catalog for her forthcoming Outliers and American Vanguard Art exhibition, which opens at the end of this month, I've come to feel lately that Steinberg's outsider status shouldn't be handled with kid gloves, but recognized for what it is. Being outsiders, or as Lynn Cook calls them, outliers, is not something to defend against. As Lynn writes, an outlier is someone beyond the statistical norm. Thus, it's not a judgment of quality or a judgment about a level of sophistication. Steinberg was not part of the mainstream practice of his time. As he himself said, "I don't quite belong in the art, cartoon, or magazine world, so the art world doesn't quite know how to place me." Having borderline status meant that he was able to operate in the margins, and those margins afforded him rich opportunities. I am suggesting that advocates for Steinberg not be so preoccupied with refuting such terms as illustrator or cartoonist, but making peace with them, or at the very least, acknowledging that Steinberg took a different path. He was an enormously successful commercial artist. And in relation to the mainstream art world, commercial artists are fringe dwellers. Living on the fringe afforded him a great deal of freedom, though. He saw himself as having, and here I quote, started at the bottom with cartoons. He learned by working and managed to get beyond some of the vulgarities, he said, of humorous drawing and the banalities of commercial art, while still preserving, he said, a little of that element of mediocrity, I'd almost say vulgarity, that I wouldn't care to give up, since I consider it something necessary, like a man who, in changing his social class, still wouldn't want to break up with his wife and old friends. And there's a coda here that I'm going to discuss, which is this work by Stuart Davis. Why I'm showing it to you is a sort of cautionary tale. One of the foolish failings of my career here as a curator was that I was offered this work by a dealer for the National Gallery's collection decades ago, and I immediately thought it was terrific. We really needed a great work by Stuart Davis, and it was not inexpensive, but given its color, it seemed absolutely the sort of right style we wanted for that period, I was on board. And then I got back here, and I thought about it, and I thought about it. And I must admit that I became somewhat nervous about the fact that it was a magazine cover. It was a magazine cover that, it's a study for the cover, that Davis did for Art Digest in 1953. So immediately in my head, I was thinking, well, I'm presenting a great work by an important artist, but is it okay that it's a magazine cover, which is the same sort of issue that circles around Steinberg? And then, to make matters worse, even more foolishly, I became consumed with the idea that it was for Christmas, and that maybe somehow that it didn't have, you know, some sort of serious subject, and that it was a magazine cover, and that it was done on commission, you know, all of these things sort of piled up, and I backed away. And that was a real mistake, and certainly a cautionary tale to others. And I think now, having been around longer and building some confidence, but in particular, having worked with Saul Steinberg's art and seeing what Lynn Cook is doing in the Outliers exhibition, I really feel that I can dismiss all those notions about who's on the outside, what's on the outside, who's on the inside. I'm not lumping them all together. I'm not saying that one would look at Steinberg's art precisely the way one would look at a Jackson Pollock, Lavender Mist, for example. What I am saying is that they did come to it from different sectors. They came to it with different ideas. And for Steinberg, that did put him on the fringe. Davis worked commercially, a lot of artists did. But then they moved away from it, and that somehow made it okay. That made them fine artists, as we say. And all of that is changing now. I think there's a real reappraisal of who these people are, how they got there, what they bring to the table. And to my mind, it's all a great reappraisal to have. And I end that, probably I should say, please go see the Saul Steinberg installation if you haven't, and I do suggest that, but also as almost a sort of ad to come see the Outlier exhibition, which opens here at the end of January. Okay, well, thank you very, very much for coming today. I appreciate it, and go see the exhibition.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.